So everything you touch, when you go into the details, when you really try to squeeze out the last 10%, that's really when it gets complicated, and you really need, it's really difficult to cover so many areas. That's really the challenge. The last, you know, 5% of something is for 90% of the workers.
Okay, hi Mate. Thank you very much for joining this podcast here at the Web Summit. It's really an honor to meet you also in person.
Thank you, likewise.
And I did a post even of your remark on my Instagram yesterday, because honestly, I'm a fan of what you're doing.
Thanks.
It's really, really fascinating. And maybe to begin with, one thing also that the listener and myself and things, what all of us sometimes is not so easy. It's really to find that passion, to find that dream in life. Yeah, of course, I had the good fortune of finding it, but not so many people, I think, find it. And it takes a lot of time sometimes. And I would like to go into you. I read that you, when you were very young, can you take us through that a little bit? You already developed this passion and direction and dream.
Yeah, for some reason, I'm obsessed with cars and technology since ever, like before I can remember. I don't have a history. So I was born in back that time it was Yugoslavia. Now the part where I was born is Bosnia, and Bosnia is the second poorest country in Europe, and where I was born is the poorest part of Bosnia. So there were no cars, there were no roads.
It's not a great start for developing a hypercar, right?
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, nobody had anything to do with cars, like my family or something like that, like just normal people. And I was for some reason obsessed with cars since ever.
And you can't remember where that first spark came from?
No, my grandfather had an old Volkswagen Beetle, and my parents told me that I used to pretend when I was a baby that my hand hurts so that they get me behind the wheel of the car, and then I would grab the steering wheel and I would remember, I would forget that I was pretending that my hand hurts. So that was before I could talk, when I was less than a year old. So I don't know where that obsession comes from, and forever I was just obsessed with cars. Then when I was older, I grew up in Germany during the war, so I looked at, you know, in German television shows, like on DSF, there was Automotor und Sport and stuff like that. I was reading all the magazines from beginning to the end. I knew, you know, the diameters of the discs of all the cars on the market. You know, I was really obsessed. So I'm lucky today that my life is still evolving around cars, that I'm doing what I really love to do, and that's, you know, more the technology behind the cars, but also cars themselves. I just think they are such an incredible combination of technology, art, you know, beauty, functionality. It's so many disciplines combined. You know, it's everything that humanity is doing is in there, like from material sciences, connectivity, simulations, you know, everything that humankind is doing is in a way embedded in the cars. And in the end, you know, the difference maybe to other products, like, let's say, highly complex products like planes, you know, they have to be functional because they are bought by big corporations. But the car in the end also has to be beautiful. Like you care about little things, like how the button reacts when you push it, like what's the feedback of that. So I don't think there's another product that combines all of that. And that's just fascinating to me.
And then the next big, we have a common racing passion as well.
Yeah.
And that's where another next big step for your life came, right? No, a little bit by coincidence as well, no? In the racing path?
Yeah, so I was first quite a lot in technology. So I was in mechatronics high school in Croatia. We moved back when I was like 14 years old. From Germany, we moved back to Croatia. And I was in this mechatronic high school, and my professor saw that I had a little gift for, you know, doing things
tiny
on my
one,
own.
Huh? Yeah. Small gift.
No, I wasn't really, I wasn't like an average student. I was not a good student, but my professor liked what I was doing. So like,
can I just interrupt there? It's interesting that you say you were not a good student,
no,
huh?
No.
And then still you were able to create such an incredible thing. So even for the students listening,
don't try to copy that. Try to be good students.
Even if you're not the best in university, don't worry. There's still huge hope that you can then find your purpose and motivation afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Because I didn't care about the boring stuff. I cared about the things that really interested me, and there I was really putting my effort into. So as graduation, project in high school in Croatia. I have to build something physical. So I have built this glove that replaces keyboard and mouse just as a school project. My professor said, that's interesting. So let's go to a competition. And I thought, like, what? I'm not a good student. So how should I go to a competition? And I didn't think anything about it. So I won, surprisingly, this local level of the competition. Then, you know, even more surprisingly, I won it on the national level. And from there on, they sent me to represent Croatia all around the world in this electronics and innovation competitions. And I thought I have no chance against, you know, Germans, Japanese, Chinese, whatever. And so that was when I was 17 years old. And I came back mostly home with gold and silver medals, which was great just to get started, to learn and to get the confidence that, okay, you know, I can do something that's you know, competitive against others. I made two patents when I was 17 years old. But my first, you know, my real passion was cars. So this was, you know, electronics and stuff.
So just until then, you didn't think so much of yourself, yeah? You didn't have the confidence that you were great at innovating in technology. You didn't think so.
No, why would I? I was just doing, you know, some stuff in my garage and I wasn't a great student. So if it wasn't for that professor, who I'm really thankful for, you know, who pushed me like, you can do this. Maybe I wouldn't have done anything of what we are doing today and what the company has become today. He just gave me that confidence and like, go out there, try to do it. And what's great about these things, you know, what I really also encourage, you know, students when they ask me what they should study and so on, like in universities, you have this formal student projects, and projects like that where you really get hands on and you really do stuff, because that's the real life. You have deadlines, you know, there is a race or something, there is this competition and it has to work. And you will work your ass off day and night to get it done. And, you know, work in the, I don't know, in the hotel or work while traveling there, you know, to make it work. You have to learn how to present it, how to get things together with everything falling apart. And, you know, that's the real life. And in the normal university, in a normal school, you don't really learn that. So these side projects are, I think, really important, you know, for people who really want to get into the work life soon and do something more. They should not just do the university and school, but try to do those real things on the side. That's my opinion.
No, I understand and I agree. Maybe we skip then to your racing activities with your famous BMW car,
yeah,
which then suddenly blew the engine.
Yeah, I always wanted to get in racing, but you know, my parents didn't really listen to me, so I had to wait until I was 18 years old. So when I was 18, I bought a 1984 BMW 3 Series.
So they didn't see the incredible driving talent.
Yeah. Well, we will never know, because I just raced like 2 times with this car. So, you know, that was the easiest way to get into racing. Like, you just buy an old rear-wheel drive car, you buy a couple of spare wheels and drifting. So you just replace with old tires and drift around. So that's what I was doing with this BMW. So that car was 4 years older than I am. And of course, the engine blew up like after 2 races. And I had this idea of like, for being from Croatia, I read a lot about Nikola Tesla. So he was also born in Croatia and I was always fascinated by him. And especially by the electric motor, which is his invention, the alternating current electric motor. And I was wondering, why is nobody using this perfect machine to power a sports car? Back then, it's quite difficult to imagine. Like 10 years ago, the mindset about electric cars was totally different. Now you have Formula E, you have Tesla, you have Rimac, you have other companies who make sexy electric cars. But back then, electric cars were equal to wheelchairs or to milk delivery vans and, you know, stuff like that. So back then it was not obvious that electric cars could be something interesting and sexy. And looking at this hole under my bonnet where the engine used to be, I said, okay, I'm going to do this a reality instead of just buying. To be honest, actually, like the real story is this. I wanted to upgrade the E30 with a M5 V8, like E39 engine.
So quick break, just exclusively for you, listener. Yeah, here comes the real story. Why Rimac exists?
Yeah. That was the real story. I saw some projects on the internet where people have done these swaps, put the M5 engine, like B turbo and stuff, like into the E30, which was really cool, but was really expensive. So I thought this other thing I had in mind is something more interesting. Like that's something that nobody has done. And I wanted to show that electric cars can be exciting and fast and not just, you know, some boring old dull machines. So that's what I did. I converted the car to an electric car, and I started to compete against gas-powered cars because there was no other electric cars to race against. And in the beginning, you know, these races, drag races and drift races, everybody was just laughing, like, what are you doing there with this washing machine? They can charge their phones in my car and stuff like that. Actually, another funny story is some of the jokes were like, go away with that car, thunder will hit us. And then I was at a race where there were like 400 other cars. And it started like a big storm was coming. And everybody, you know, just parked their cars. And then the thunderstorm started. And the thunder hit exactly into my car amongst these 400 cars on the racetrack. So there must have been something about
that's
that.
That's a sign. No?
Yeah, that was a sign, yeah. Nikola Tesla's hand.
Exactly.
So that car, you know, at the beginning, everybody was laughing. But after, and I had lots of problems, like the car would fail in the middle of the racetrack and it wouldn't really work well. But after every race, I was improving the car. It improved more and more, became faster and faster, more reliable. And after some time, it started winning. In 2010, I won the first race. And in 2011, I broke 5 FIA and Guinness World Records for the fastest accelerating car.
Ah, so this is a drag race, yeah?
Yeah, so for the fastest acceleration, the 8 mile, quarter mile, half mile, half kilometer, kilometer, something like that.
So the 100 meters, 0 to 100 was?
With that, at that 3.3 seconds with the old BMW. And it was still like, I didn't change any like body panels. It was all steel, glass, you know, it was really heavy. But it was like the perfect way to learn. I got hit by the electricity like 1,000 times.
Really?
Yeah, the batteries burned, motors blown up, differentials fell apart. And to be honest, it's the most fun part of my life. Because now, you know, Rimac is a 500 people company almost. There's lots of things that, you know, you have to do to manage the company, to keep it survive and so on. That time in the garage, fooling around with the BMW, preparing it for the next race, that was really the most fun part.
But your ambition there was just to prove that you could build that race car on electric power, which could beat everybody else? It was quite simple at the time, or was there a bigger vision already?
No, I wanted to make a business out of it from the beginning. And in the beginning, I thought I will make a conversion business. So to help other people convert electric cars, like regular cars to electric. It seemed like so far out that electric cars will really become mainstream. And I started with that. And then I realized that this doesn't really make sense. And I still get this question today a lot, like, can you convert this car to electric and so on? And I realized that doesn't really make sense because the electric propulsion is so different than the combustion engine. And for every car, you have to change a lot of things and so on. So it's never worthwhile, really, it's a cool hobby to convert your car to electric car, but it's never going to be a real business. Lots of people have tried that and it didn't really work. So then I basically was inspired by Christian Koenigsegg and Horacio Pagani. I knew that hundreds of people have tried to build their own car and that so many have failed, that the car industry is one of the most difficult to get into. It's the industry with the highest entry barriers. But I thought if these guys have made their cars, and I was so admiring them. I was so admiring Christian from Koenigsegg and Horacio.
Did you have the privilege to meet them in that time?
At that time, no.
No.
Now we are friends.
Of course.
Both.
Yeah.
But at that time, it's also a little bit difficult really to remember that. I'm also a little bit surprised. Like, I know I was in 1 year, I went to Geneva to the motor show and I wanted to move to meet Christian. I knew about him, you know, but I didn't really know how he looked like. Today, it's really strange. Like, you have millions of YouTube videos, but back then, probably there wasn't. So it's difficult to remember. So I ran into his father. And he gave me his business card, Christian's business card. And I told him about the BMW. I wrote him an email and what I was doing. And Christian is a very, very smart guy. So he knew that electric cars will become a hot topic. So he said, okay, cool. It's really interesting what you're doing. So please keep me posted. So I was sending him updates back then and so on. So in that way, we kind of met. But it was a lot later than we started to work together. So yeah, I wanted, you know, from this BMW to make my own car. And at that time, I met Adriano, who is today our head of design. He was working for GM in Rüsselsheim, in Opel, actually. And I was just a college student, and we decided to make a car together. And he was doing the design, I was doing the technology, and we wanted to make like a real proper electric supercar, and not just making a supercar electric, but actually taking all the advantages that an electric powertrain can give you to make a better sports car. So we thought like that's going to be the sports car of the 21st century. So one of the things that we wanted to do with electric powertrains, for example, you can have 4 motors, one for each wheel, where you can control each wheel independently. very precisely. So for example, you can have three wheels accelerating each at a different rate and one wheel braking. That's something that you cannot do with a traditional powertrain. And it's something that allows you to have degrees of freedom that are not possible with a combustion engine. So that was really the idea to make the next generation sports car. And we were just two guys trying to do something that we knew it's nearly impossible.
Sounds very simple. Huh? Why not? Yeah. Let's just go in our garage, the two of us. Let's make the fastest sports car in the 21st century, no?
Yeah, that was
easy.
That was quite
in Croatia, in the middle of nowhere, yeah. For the automobile industry. Huh?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that was another topic. Like when I started, I went to the University of Mechanical Engineering in Zagreb because Croatia. Like if you Google automotive industry in Europe and you go to the pictures, and the first picture you get is like dots of the European map where the car industry is, where they have suppliers and so on. So it's not just Germany and France.
Is there any dot in Croatia?
It's the only country in Europe that doesn't have any dot. So unfortunately, there is not a lot of industry. Croatia is such an amazing country, such a beautiful country. Have you been to Croatia?
I don't think so, no. Oh, no, I have. I have. I've done a boat, a little vacation.
Okay, yeah, so you know it's beautiful.
Beautiful, yeah. Really stunning, yes.
It's I think, the most beautiful country in the world, but not for industry, and especially not for the car industry. So I went to the University of Mechanical Engineering in Zagreb and told them I want to make a car. And I have already proven with my BMW that I know a couple of things about it. And they told me, don't do that. It's impossible to do that in Croatia. The sooner you give up, the less people will go under with you. So I realized, okay, nobody can really help me in Croatia. So I have to try to do it somehow. That's how it started, basically.
That's amazing. And then how did you manage to get funding then to get the first steps going? I mean, you had this great vision. You had proven on your BMW that you have the competence to get technology up to a certain level. But then what were the steps to go out there and get backing to make this vision reality and actually make this phenomenal concept one suddenly exist?
Yeah, that was the most difficult thing. And my job mostly from the beginning of the company until today, my job is to find the investors and, you know, negotiate with them and manage to help to keep the company surviving. Like I just read just listened to a interview from Elon Musk where, you know, he has done lots of things and he said the most difficult thing in his life is to keep a car company alive. That's really, really incredible.
You agree?
So the odds of us surviving any of the stages where you were almost zero.
What was your toughest period?
All the time.
So actually,
the tough period was last time, but the beginning was really difficult because, so there we were, just Adriana and myself, and we had sketches and renderings and 3D models and stuff. And, you know, we weren't sure what's the plan? And then there was a guy from Croatia who by coincidence, you know, he read about the stuff I was doing with the BMW, like there is a green BMW beating gas-powered cars on the racetracks. And he said, I work for a royal family in the Middle East and they are always looking for interesting investments. So what can you show me? Like I can show to them. And we put together a little brochure. I still have that. And there was like the specifications of the car, renderings, but everything was virtual. Like nothing existed really other than the BMW. And he called me and said, the guys want to order two cars. I was like, great, but there is no company. There is no car. There's nothing. And the next day he called me, how much do you need? And I started to put together a business plan. Of course, I had absolutely no idea how much money it takes. I had absolutely no idea what it takes to build a car.
But of course, very important, don't never show that, huh?
Show
you have everything under control. Yeah. It's going to be super planned out.
Yeah. Well, actually...
So you're a good showmaster as well then, yeah? A good actor.
I'm quite bad at that, actually. Like I learned there's so much hot air in this industry. There's so many, you know, newcomers that disappear the next year and, you know, show something but never prove that they have done this stuff. So we have this other approach. Like we are totally open. Like anybody can come into our company, like on our website, just go factory tour and see absolutely everything we do. Even if it's the, you know, somebody who wants to exactly copy our business model. We had also guys like that came there and, you know, we asked them, okay, so what do you guys do? Well, actually, you want to do this, this and that. And that sounds very similar. So we don't have any problem with that. We are very open and we try to be very honest because there's so much hot air in this industry. And I think it's important to really be realistic. So, we really had no idea what we were doing. And the initial team that I put together, nobody has done anything like that. And I couldn't find anybody in Croatia who was doing that. If you go now to our website, there are 120 openings on our website. And it's not that that we cannot hire the people in Croatia who can do these jobs. There are simply no people who have done anything similar like that. Like if you have crash simulation specialist or aerodynamics, you know, specialist, stuff like that. Nobody has done anything like that there. So we had to build up all the competences initially on our own because we couldn't afford to hire foreigners with those experiences. So yeah, it was tough from every perspective, from the funding, which was the most difficult part, from technical side, from, you know, managing the people, growing a company to this level, like almost 500 employees right now, like how to structure that, how to get the processes in place, how to do the organization of the company. All of that is a very difficult learning curve, especially if you haven't done anything before, because I started a company when I was, you know, just 20 years old. So yeah, it was a wild ride. The last 10 years were really something interesting.
And how do you personally cope with sometimes where you have been then close to failure? How do you personally cope with those situations? Are you scared, or what is the motivation to keep pushing?
Well, we are almost always close to failing, really. It's incredible. Like I don't think that anybody really understands that except the people who are really close to me or in the beginning of the team. Like in the first 6 years, I never had the money to pay the next salary on the account. We never had
that.
Like,
sounds crazy.
You know, in startup world you say like runway.
Yeah.
Like that's how long you have to survive. And when I read about some companies that got nervous when they got a 6 month runway, I was like, what's a 6 month runway? I would kill for that. We always survived somehow, just in the last moment. We just made it to the next month and so on. We had situations where we couldn't pay the rent, so the people wanted to throw us out. The electricity company cut our electricity. We had like all of that stuff. But there are so many. Like one of the public moments that people like to mention to me a lot is the Hammond crash.
Yeah, I was going to touch on that later, actually.
Yeah, so like that's a public catastrophe that happened and that everybody knows. But there are like a million of these that, you know, are in another way, you know, not public. Like, you know, problems with investors, with, I don't know, with some projects, with technical. Like, so you have all of these roadblocks that each of them can cost you the life of the company, each of them. And the more of them they are, the more likely you are to fail. But they are going, like, it's never going to be perfect. Every day, like, I know if I don't look at my phone, like now when we are talking, when I don't look at my phone for 1 hour and I look at it now later, that there will be like one middle catastrophe. I hope not the big one.
I'm so sorry. Thank you that you're taking the time anyways.
No, because, you know, there's so much things happening. And yeah, always there are huge problems. And you have to deal with that. My job in the end...
Problem solver.
Exactly. And that's really like the frustrating part in the end. Because everybody comes to me with their problems. With like, this doesn't work. This is a problem. This guy has doing this stuff. And, you know, so the CEO in the end is the guy who is responsible and who has to solve all of these things. But of course, you need a really good team behind that to rely on to make this possible.
But can it still be enjoyable then if it's just problem solving all the time?
That's why I said the garage was the most interesting and coolest part of the history, because now I deal all the time with Excel sheets, with financials, with investors, with contracts, and very little time and focus remains for the interesting stuff, for the technological part. So it is still fun. It's fun to see our results, to see, you know, what motivates me is just to take a walk through the company, see the people, what incredible things they are doing, what a team we have built, how dedicated they are. And that's like, you know, we have to keep this going. Like this has to survive. This has to deliver on those things that we want to do. That's my biggest motivation. But day-to-day stuff, it's really tough. Yeah.
And so you've developed a great care for your business family now, yeah? Everybody at Rematz that's working so hard and all the technology and innovation that you've achieved, yeah?
Yes. Well, you know, from one side, I think it's important. Like there are several important things. So from one side, we really push the limits of technology. That's what we are all about. We, you know, we don't want to be yet another company trying to do the same thing. We really are about showing what's possible, building the best. From that perspective, it's important. From the other perspective, the people that are working in the company, that, you know, there are, that we have built such a unique culture and unique company where so many things are happening at the same place and so advanced. That's important. And then also for the country to show that this is possible and to attract other companies to Croatia, to not be the country where there is no dot of automotive industry, but to really put it on that map as well. So from several perspectives, I think it's important that the company survives and thrives. And yeah, that's my job to make sure that happens.
Moving on maybe to the Rimac. How would you pronounce it exactly?
Well, in Croatia, Rimac. It's Rimac.
Rimac, okay. There
you go. I know many people have difficulties.
Rimac, of course, with, internationally.
Yeah, so it's okay. When I was in Germany, they couldn't say Rimac, so I was Rimac. So I understand that it's not a problem.
So Rimac 2 coming out. When is the first one going to be sold? Delivered.
Yeah, that's always what people also don't understand. Selling is one thing, delivering is another. So deliveries are starting in 2020. We are now building the prototypes and doing all the crash testing program. So this car, you know, you would have on one end of the spectrum really small manufacturers that would maybe make two prototypes and do the full development and testing with that. On the other hand of the spectrum, you would have the big OEMs doing 500 prototypes. We want to do it properly. And we are doing something, we'll produce something like 20 to 25 prototypes because we want to do, first of all, global homologation. So it has to fulfill all the same requirements, all the crash tests, everything like any other car. So no exemptions because it's a small volume car. So we really want to make sure it's completely safe, like on the level of the most, you know, best cars currently out there. And it's a very big program for us. It's a big step going from 8 concept ones to 150 C2s. Which will be even more with other variants and so on. And on the other side, we also have the bigger part of our business, which is the components that we deliver to the other manufacturers. So the company is going through a big transition. Just in the last year and a half, we have doubled from 200 people to, I think we are with something like 480 now. So it's a lot of things that have to happen to make that a reality. But the biggest project is the C2, because for us, it's not just the car. You know, just to give you an example, people ask us, how long does it take you to build a car? And other car manufacturers, they consider that putting the parts together because they, for example, other supercar companies, some of them don't make one single part of their car. They have suppliers, which is, you know, also very legit. It's their part of it's how they do business. We have decided to be very vertically integrated in development and production. One of the reasons also being that we are in Croatia where there's no really supplier base to do the things we want to do. So for us, for example, to develop a part, so let's say carbon fiber part, you design it, you engineer the tooling, you produce the tool, you produce the carbon part, then in the end, you paint it, put it on the car. So it's a long process for the whole chain to happen. So it's a lot of activity. It's thousands of parts. And what we do in that car, for example, the motor that we develop for that car, we will use for projects of other car manufacturers. So the battery that's developed for the C2, it's a new generation battery, will end up in, I don't know, maybe an Aston Martin or another car like that. So that's much more than a car for us. It's a technology demonstrator. And the infotainment, the powertrain, the battery, the inverter, the gearbox, all of that are technologies that we will apply somewhere else as well.
It's unbelievable to me to hear this, yeah, that you are in Croatia pioneering the way in the global automotive market in all these different individual spaces. This is really, really, really fascinating. And can you tell us a little bit about the Rimac C2 performance specials? For example, of course, the 0 to 100. I think this is for the listener going to be an incredible. Please sit down, dear listener. Yeah, because this number is going to be absolutely shocking.
Yeah. Again, being fully honest, Marta will not
like
that.
Honest, this is a very honest podcast, it seems.
Yeah, so the numbers, you know, you have in this category, the cars are sold by the numbers. Unfortunately, I had also the discussions. For example, a good friend of mine is Anthony Sheriff, the ex-CEO of McLaren. And we shared this vision a little bit. You know, people want, you know, this 1,000-something horsepower car. The 0 to 60 is very important. So what the C1, the concept one had a 2-speed double clutch gearbox in the end. So 4 motors, the front motor had a single speed gearbox, the rear motor had a 2-speed double clutch. And we realized when we were driving the car, you drive it all the time in second gear And it's so fast in second gear. It's faster than almost anything else. So you start with the second gear and you blow off, like you really try that with, you know, with various cars, and it's so much faster than them in the second gear. If you put it in the first gear and do the proper launch, it's faster than anything. But that's like going from maybe 2.8 seconds to 2.2 in that scenario with the Concept One. With the C2, we really wanted to avoid the two-speed gearbox because it's such a big part. It's so complex to manufacture, so heavy, so inefficient, and so on. And we developed a completely new powertrain, inverter, motor, gearbox, everything to achieve our targets, which was about 2.3, I think, something like that. Yeah, 2.3 was the target, 0 to 100, with a single-speed gearbox and a top speed of over 350. And we managed to do that. And then Tesla came out with the Roadster, and they claimed a 1.9 second to 100 and over 400 kilometers per hour.
But we know that Elon likes to overclaim a little bit sometimes, huh?
Well, we'll see about, maybe with timing, but with technical parameters, they were always quite there. So lots of people tell me that as well, but we'll see, you know. And we said, okay, we'll sacrifice. So now the car is faster. We have now in the C2 also two-speed gearbox in the rear.
Elon forced you to put the two-speed.
Yes.
You could not accept that Elon was going to beat you on the 0 to 100.
That was really difficult because we already had the space for the powertrain, for the chassis, for the motors and everything. It was incredibly difficult to get more space to put a two-speed gearbox. So we had like 100 concepts how to make that. And the gearbox is, again, incredibly complex and so on. And now we have 1.85 to 0 to 60 time and 1.97 0 to 100 time. And I tell you, because of that, it's a worse car. It's not going to be a better car. It's going to be a worse car, but everybody is going to look at the papers. And why worse? Because it's more heavy. It's more complex. It's more weight in the rear, not in the front. So the balance is a little bit worse. It's less efficient because the more moving parts and so on. But on paper, it will look better. So that's maybe something that not many people will tell you in this industry. That's very number driven. So on one side is the numbers, and what we really wanted to achieve with this car, it's also to be very functional. We want people who own those cars to enjoy using them, not just put them on the garage. So one example that you wouldn't really notice, for example, when you go in some other supercars, you have to put your bottom on the sill of the big monocoque and then slide onto the seat. So what we wanted to do, for example, when the big door opens, so big door that you can get easily in and out, you can sit on the seat and put your foot down on the ground, on the floor, without lifting your bottom first. So it's a small sill. Sounds like a little thing, but to achieve the crash safety, the rigidness of the monocoque, to not break in the front impact, for example, with such a small sill, it's really difficult, especially with such a heavy car like a supercar. Then it has lots of high-tech features with facial recognition, with infotainment and so on. 600 kilometers of range with 120 kilowatt hours of battery. We are developing some very interesting self-driving functions.
Level 4, I've read. Like, this is amazing. Your target, huh?
Level 4 ready. So the car... So what's also important to understand is that a car... regardless of the AI, of the actual function, just the car to be able to handle self-driving functions is developed in a completely different way than a traditional car. So to have the redundancies, to have the systems that are able to fulfill the safety requirements, the electronics, the actuators, for example, with a hydraulic steering system, you can never achieve self-driving because you don't have an actuator. How will you steer the car? Or with the braking system, you have to have at least two redundancy levels. So it's a completely different architecture of the whole car. So the car is level 4 ready from that perspective, but we are developing some so we are not developing functions like Waymo or Google to get you from point A to point B. What we are trying to do, like going 10 years back, when I said electric cars and high performance and enjoyment and so on, it was like didn't work together. People didn't understand, like, how can an electric car be fun? And I think in the last 10 years, the mindset has changed, and Formula E and us and other people have...
Well, not yet completely. Huh? It's changing.
It's changing,
but it
yes.
will still take time. But I agree, electric cars are awesome.
Yeah, it's different. And now with autonomous driving, people say this also doesn't work. Like, it's taking away the driving and so on. We want to prove that it's not the case, that it can enhance driving, it can make it more fun. What you're developing is a driver coach. So you go to a racetrack, it gives you like two perfect laps on Hockenheim, for example. And then when you take over, it coaches you how to be a better driver. You know, have, for example, you as the coach inside of the car without having you in the car. So, like having your ideal line shown to the customers and stuff like that.
But you need a sample case driver to set the benchmark for the artificial intelligence, no?
No, it can be just the AI calculating the ideal scenario.
On a racetrack?
Yeah.
Because we have the Robo Race and everything, and it still seems miles away to be able to get close with AI to what a human being, or to what I, for example, could do on a racetrack.
You're superhuman. No. It's of course taking time. But you know, going to first principles, there's absolutely no reason why the autonomous self-driving system wouldn't be better than you.
Oh no, I agree. But what a mission!
Yes, it has to be. There's lots of work, especially at very high speeds. But
did you see my Porsche 918 video on YouTube now?
Yeah.
To get the AI to do that, I think it's going to take a bit of time.
That's what we're trying to do. Yes, including drifting. Yeah. So, but of course, it's a lot of work. So we are working on that.
That's unbelievable. Like every time you think, okay, yeah, no more extra complications.
Oh yes.
You add another whole layer of complications.
Yeah,
how on earth do you manage to keep? It just seems like unbelievable.
But that's really what you said is really crucial, because, for example, when we presented the first Concept One in Frankfurt, you were six people in the company. It was not really the real car. It was like it took a lot of time to get it to you know, a level where we started to deliver them. But at that time, maybe one guy was developing the battery for that car. Now we have a department of 50 people developing batteries. It's more like almost 10 times more than the whole company was back then. So everything you touch, when you go into the details, when you really try to squeeze out the last 10%, that's really when it gets complicated, and you really need, it's really difficult to cover so many areas. That's really the challenge. The last, you know, 5% of something is for 90% of the workers.
Yeah, and just to tell our listeners, so Porsche bought 10% of your company. Mm-hmm. Mainly because they were so amazed and interested in your technology that you've developed, yeah, your battery system and your electric motors and everything else. So that's really already a testament to the incredible place that you're at with your company, that the global powerhouse Porsche, who even is one of the pioneers of electric mobility,
yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
In that, from the normal manufacturers, yeah? Because I think they've done a good job as well to really anticipate and get this Mission-E out on the road as one of the first is quite cool that they've managed to do that. And still they're coming to you for your technology. So this is really very, very, very awesome.
Yes, and I consider that one of our biggest achievements, or one of my personal biggest achievements, because Porsche is the perfect partner. So they have scale, they know how to produce in mass, and they are pioneers. They are on the forefront of technology. They are really an engineering company, a real true German, like hardcore engineering company. And they have a little bit of that not developed here. Like if it's not developed here, it's not good. And they never invested in other companies. So it was really something interesting to get into this process with them. It took 3 years from when we met until we did the investment. You know, going through all of the the scans of the business, the due diligence process, meeting all of the board members and stuff like that. That was really, really an interesting ride. But it's a win-win situation.
You had the patience.
Well, for Porsche, of course, yeah. But that's one of the things when you ask me, like, what is my job, like. I was working so much on that deal. Like I went to Stuttgart, like, I don't know, 5 times. They came to us like 10 times or maybe 15 times, and contracts, lawyers, all of that. That's like really a long, long process to make that happen.
Oof. Now to the most important question of the entire day. When could I try the Concept 2 Rimac? Please.
You want to try one?
I would love to try it.
You have to come to Croatia. No. First, you have to see how we develop it, how we make it. That's really important, I think. That's what I'm most proud of, to show you really how this process is happening and how that all happens under one roof. Like, I love to show people around, because it's such a unique place where you can really see everything happening there. And then you can drive a car. So let's organize that for next year.
And I promise I'm a better driver than Richard Hammond. I promise you, it will come back in one piece.
Well, actually, he asked also about driving the C2, and I said, absolutely no problem.
You did?
Of course,
oh,
yeah,
come on,
not?
You should never be ever allowed to drive a Rimac again in the whole,
no, why
in
not?
The whole world.
Why not?
So my really coming to the end, my question would be, what is your vision now for how you want to impact the world or in 5 to 10 years' time? Because you know that, well, we all know mobility is completely changing. What is your vision? Where are you going? And what impact are you going to have and do you want to have? And are you then going to be less of a problem solver one day as well?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I don't know where to start with that really, because I'm a little bit torn apart. On one side, I'm a petrol head. I love cars. Like if I had the money, I would buy myself like all of the supercars, hypercars, like combustion, hybrid, electric, all of that, because I love cars. But on the other side, it's the data that tells you that that doesn't make any sense. Like, it's for sure. I'm 100% sure that we will not own cars anymore in the future. We will not drive them anymore. We will use them as a mobility service, and it will have such a big impact on society, on people. Like, it's not just the way, like our convenience or something like that. 1.2 million people die on the roads every year. I read some analysis which says that because of accidents and the congestion that's happening because of that, because of the health cost, because of the deaths, that there is 8% of GDP impact in the US because of that. 8% of GDP. And then congestion, 50 billion hours lost of people driving in the US being stuck in a traffic jam, that has a 9% impact on GDP. So that two together is bigger than, let's say, for example, the percentage of Croatia's GDP dependence on tourism, which is huge, one of the biggest in the world. Combined, those two things trickle down on the per mile cost of you driving the car. It's the highest cost factor, more than gas, more than depreciation of the car. So changing the mobility, not owning your car, not driving it, is going to have a huge impact on society, on productivity, on health of people, on absolutely every aspect of life. And this is going to result in very big changes for the industry. How will car companies cope with that? How will the owners of cars cope with that? How infrastructure will change? Just to give you an example, 70% of police in the US, for example, is related to traffic. So you don't need 70% of the police anymore when there are no more drivers. 40% of airport income comes from parking. So how does that change? 50% of municipality income, like parking tickets and stuff like that, comes from cars as well, is related in some way to cars. So the whole world can change with that. It's not just about us car guys. It's, I think, you know, capitalism needs constant growth. And with limited space and people and resources, how do you grow? And this next productivity growth, I think, will come from autonomous vehicles. And we are also working on in different ways with also other car manufacturers in that. So how does that work with our supercars, you ask? Of course, you know, there will to start.
Thank you for asking the question.
Yeah. I know. That's why I say it's really a difficult question to ask, because we are this crossroad. The whole industry is going to change.
I'm going to go to the bathroom. You can just continue.
Yeah. So, of course, more near term, the company, Rimac as a company, we have the big goal of bringing the car to production, of scaling up our production capabilities for our components and so on, working with the big car companies to help bring their cars on the market. But the real big changes are not that. The real big change is not electrification. The real big change is the change in mobility, and electrification will come as a consequence of that. But then you will not care anymore what powers the car that drives you. You will not know. Well, how do you care? Do you care about the acceleration of the train where you are, about the brakes in the train, about the motor in the train? No, you don't. So it's going to be completely different. So I didn't, I think, really answer your question other than nobody really knows what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, but everybody knows it's going to be a huge change. And we will be part of that in some way.
So you want to make sure that you as a company have a big impact in that space in changing the world?
Yeah, we think we will. But also to tell you, in the end, you know, our grandparents probably all had horses, right? And they loved their horses. And they knew, like, this is a good horse, this is not a good horse. This is a racing horse, this is a workhorse. Now we have no idea. Well, at least I don't have. And we don't own horses. But there are people who have racehorses. So luckily, there will be people like us who will still have supercars and will love them, but probably we will not be able to use them everywhere. There will be designated areas we'll use them, and we will have our race horses that still maybe run on fuel and we still drive them and so on. So there's good news also a little bit for petrol heads, but I think it's going to be a very small fraction of the society that will care about cars, to be honest.
But I hope that that still stays. Of course, we all still want to have that space where we can drive and have fun and enjoy fast cars and the thrill, of course.
Yeah, well,
huh?
We're counting on you. Let's look back in 30 years at this video and see how much people will still care. I'm really curious about that. Maybe it will not change a lot. Maybe it will change completely. We'll see.
And what about you personally? You're saying you have much less fun now because you're just a problem solver, yeah? You used to have much more fun back in the day. So what about you personally? Where are you going to then go? I mean, I think you must strive to, again, come into a position where you have much more fun in life and in job or not?
No, you have, like, if you want to do something really difficult, like we are trying to do, and something that's nearly impossible, you have to make your own choice. Like, do you want to hang out with your friends and with your family and have vacations and travel the world and see things? Then this is not for you. Like, okay, maybe an employee, but not in a position where you are responsible. I have made a decision for myself, and I'm not putting myself in front of these 500 people and one day over 1,000 people who are working at this company. I have accepted that this is my job in the company, and that's okay. I don't have a problem with that.
And you're sure of it? Or there's every day 10 moments where you think, shit, am I really on the right path here for myself?
Like, you are scared a lot of times and you don't know if this is going to work out, if that's going to work out, what if this happens, what if that happens. It's really complex. But also, there was a lot of times when I thought, okay, this is the end. Like, no way we are going to survive this. Like, absolutely no way. And then somehow we still managed to survive through the struggle. Am I sure? I'm sure that I want to do this, that I want to bring the company to where I see it. But of course, there are always doubts. You know, we have come through the really difficult part of the early stage of the company, but it's still the odds are against us, I think. It's still more odds of us not surviving than surviving. It's still, you know, really difficult to build a car company, and we are still at the early stage. There's still a long way in front of us, but I think we have a great team, we have the right people, and that we can do that. So, but at least we will make it that you get your test drive of the C2. That's the most important thing now.
So no beach holiday anytime soon then, I guess.
No.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm really excited to get an insight. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel then also and hit the new notification button, because that's where you're going to see me drive the Rematz Concept 2 then at some point soon, hopefully. That would be awesome. And thanks for tuning in. Thank you, Matte, for a great insight and really fascinating. Amazing what you're creating. Yeah, really incredible, inspiring, I think, for the listener, well, for you who've listened, and for me as well, for everybody. So very cool. And we'll all watch how things progress.
Thanks
it's
so going
to be great to see what else you're going to achieve and how you're going to impact this mobility revolution. It's going to be really, really cool. So thank you very much.
Thank you.